You're listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. Find out how you can join us for a live show at the Cactus at cactuscafe.org.
So tonight's a little bit different. We're recording a live This Is Just to Say podcast. Has anybody listened to the podcast? Yes? All right. We have our fantastic host of the podcast up here with us this evening. So we're gonna do this as a Views and Brews and as a This Is Just to Say. The way this is going to work is I'm going to introduce our co-host tonight, and then she is going to introduce the panel. And to do that, I would like to read one of her poems. This is called Time to Be the Fine Line of Light by Carrie Fountain. Between the blind and the sill, nothing, really. There are so many things that destroy. To think solely of them is as foolish and expedient as not thinking of them at all. All I want is to be the river, though I return again and again to the clouds. All I want is to stop beginning sentences with all I want. No, really, all I want is this morning, my daughter and my son saying da back and forth over breakfast, cracking each other up while eating peanut butter toast and raspberries, making a place for the two of them. I will eventually no longer be allowed to enter. Time to be the fine line. Time to practice being the line. And then maybe the darkness. I've read that poem. Hundreds of times that I have it on my desk. I've read it to my daughter. And it wasn't until I was preparing for this show and rereading Song of Myself that I read a line in Song of Myself where Whitman is thinking about a woman giving birth. And he's thinking about the womb opening, and he writes, I recline by the sills of the exquisite flexible doors and mark the outlet and mark the relief and escape. And I thought, you know, how beautiful that, I don't know, Carrie, I'm sure you weren't thinking, how can I channel Walt Whitman for this poem? But the idea of making a space for our children, making a space for this new life, the way that Whitman was 200 years ago making this space for a new beginning and birth, I thought was such a beautiful connection and a way to begin this evening. So before further ado, Carrie has, of course, all these wonderful books of poetry, Burn Lake, what's the other one that you, whatever, it doesn't matter. And she's got a YA novel, and she's an incredible, prolific writer. The host of This Is Just to Say, Carrie Fountain.
Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you so much for coming. We're so thrilled to be sharing the stage with Views and Brews, and really, thank you to Rebecca McEnroy. Rebecca McEnroy, speaking of someone who makes space for voices and for people to come together and share ideas, I mean, she's a treasure.
Thank you.
Before I introduce our other two panelists tonight and we really start talking about Walt Whitman and his time and his influence and legacy 200 years after his birthday. I thought, I was reading today, rereading some of Song of Myself, and then looked at this. This is a selected Whitman. And there is, to begin this selection, a poem. We decided it was a poem, a standalone poem. With Walt Whitman, you know, his signature down below. And I read it and I thought, oh my gosh, this is what we need tonight to bring him into the room. And it's really quite eerie, I think, and beautiful. So this is Walt Whitman. Come, said my soul. Such verses for my body let us write, for we are one. That should I, after death, invisibly return, or long, long hence, in other spheres, there to some group of mates, the chants resuming, tallying earth's soil, trees, wind, tumultuous waves. Ever with pleased smile, I may keep on, ever and ever, yet the verses owning, as first I here and now, signing for soul and body, set to them my name, Walt Whitman.
What?
So he's here now.
Beautiful.
I think he saw, he knew this was going to be happening back then. So without further ado, let me introduce our other two panelists. Next to Rebecca, Travis Shiwing Lau received his PhD in English at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's a postdoctoral fellow, teaching fellow, at the University of Texas at Austin here, and he specializes in 18th and 19th century British literature, but tonight he's going to share his, he's going to be an, did you call it an Americanist?
Yes, I'm going to be an Americanist.
Okay, tonight.
Or fool people into thinking I want to be an Americanist.
You're crossing the pond, huh? You're like, I guess I'll come over here.
Okay. And then Micah Bateman is a Mellon Engaged Scholar Initiative Fellow. Wait, okay. That's a lot of adjectives in there. Okay. No. Mellon Engaged Scholar Initiative Fellow at the University of Texas at Austin, where he is at work on a dissertation called Hashtag Web Poet Society, Poetry in the Digital Public Sphere. And he's also a poet himself and graduated from the Iowa Writers Workshop and has recently published a chapbook of poems, Polis, from Catenary Press. And so he just completed a digital exhibition of bound volumes by Whitman for the Harry Ransom Center on campus. So he is deep in Whitman right now.
I've been steeped.
Yes, fully.
Fully.
Well, now we shall taste his knowledge. Ooh, this metaphor is going, this tea metaphor.
Okay, we're talking Whitman tonight. We can go there with bodily fluid.
So, Rebecca, why don't you start us off with, you know, why don't you open us up?
Questioning? Well, I would love, Micah, for you to kind of set the stage. Talk a little bit about who Whitman was, when he was born, what was going on, and kind of just, like, give us a little something to work with as far as time and place.
Sure. I mean, well, the reason we're convened here is because it was very recently Whitman's 200th birthday. This is the Whitman bicentennial year. He was born on May 31st in 2019. To give you a sort of taste of who else of note.
1819.
I'm sorry, what did I say?
2019.
Sorry, 1819.
Okay.
You got it. He was born 1 week after Queen Victoria and about 3 months previous to Herman Melville. He was born in Huntington, Long Island, a big family. He was the second of many children. They didn't last long on Long Island when he was born at 4. They moved to Brooklyn, and on and off throughout his life, he lived in Brooklyn. Importantly, he was one of the first of the generation of American writers, right, who was born after 1776. He's not like these poets like Philip Freneau or a poet named Joel Barlow who are writing American national poetry through the Revolution and after. It's like he's born into the America. He's also born at a time during this rapid industrialization, the tail end of Romanticism. There's a mass media and popular media that's burgeoning that he becomes intimately involved with in various ways as a typesetter and journalist and printer's apprentice. And also he's born, you know, a decade before the advent of Jacksonian democracy, before Andrew Jackson takes the presidency in 1829, and then the center of America stops being that kind of Harvard-educated aristocratic elite and starts to center the everyman. And Whitman himself was coming from a working class background. He dropped out of school at age 11, started working at age 11 and from then forward. And then, you know, was making these radical poems by the 1850s on the eve of the Civil War that were really challenging these aristocratic poets like Longfellow and Whittier. So that's where we are.
I would love to stop right there too, because in 1855, on the eve of the Civil War, he publishes Leaves of Grass. He self-publishes it. And Travis, I would love for you to talk a little bit about that first publication, what that was, what it meant to people, the expression of the body, and maybe read just the first, in the 1855 edition, the first line from I Sing the Body Electric, which I think sets the stage for how intimate this portrait was.
Yeah, I'll start with that. I'll read this first. The bodies of men and women engirth me, and I engirth them. They will not let me off, nor I them, till I go with them and respond to them and love them. I think for me, when I think about this one self-published collection in which the body is so prominent, I think was one quite radical, thinking about this moment in which both medicine and science was revolutionizing the way we were thinking about the body, but also coming from a perspective in which the body can be a topic and can be a character in and of itself in the poetry, right? So the speaker channels not only a self, but also a body that speaks, that feels, that is unabashedly itself. And that's sort of why I'm so attached to Whitman as a poet.
And then this changes a lot because He first of all, he's speaking for the body of the man, the body of women, the national body as a whole, and then the Civil War happens, and that breaks apart. And then when it was reissued, republished version, maybe read those lines after the war.
I sing the body electric. The armies of those I love engirth me, and I engirth them. They will not let me off till I go with them, respond to them, and discorrupt them, and charge them full with the charge of the soul.
So what did the war really influenced what he was writing? How did that influence also the disconnect between him, other bodies, the way that he was thinking about America as a whole?
I defer to Micah for expertise here, but I think of Whitman's own disillusionment with the concept of national identity and thinking about wartime in which individual bodies are dying on the fields and this fantasy of a national body that supposedly unifies everybody, those things feel desperately disconnected. And I hear, especially thinking about later revisions of Leaves of Grass, which was throughout Whitman's life, how he grappled with his own bodily disillusion. I believe he had a stroke, is that right?
Yes.
He had a few.
Yes.
He had a stroke to the point of being paralyzed that he didn't believe he would recover from. Isn't that right?
Right. So I'm thinking about these sort of utopian visions of what the body can do and this national body that connects the sense of Americanness being fractured quite literally in his own body and in the poetry itself. And I see him grappling with that.
I should also just say that he actually did fully recover from his stroke.
Do you read how he fully recovered?
He walked around.
And
he
wrestled with trees? That's what I read.
He wrestled with who?
Wrestled with trees, and he did this cardio, like, recitation, like, would recite poetry so it would be so invigorating that it would get him going.
And he went on a walking tour as well.
Too.
And he was a big nude sunbather, to be lost in the shuffle. Go ahead, Gary.
Yeah, not many people know he has a men's fitness column that he wrote in the 1850s.
Well, I wondered if you could also speak, because, you know, the various releases of this collection, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how they were received, how that it was received. And also, I remember reading that Walt Whitman would write under pseudonyms reviews of his own book. Whoa. Praising it.
So he's like his own PR agent.
Right.
Yeah.
He is, what does they call it? A hustle.
He's a hustler. Do you do that too, Carrie? Negative reviews too. He wrote negative reviews, not only positive reviews, right?
Is that right?
Yeah. Like he would write one that was negative.
Oh, he was trying to get the
Get the
no, there is controversy. There is no bad media coverage, right?
No, there's no bad press, and in fact, at the end of his life, he was really trying to get his name in the air by having these big, elaborate birthday celebrations for himself. And it started with his 70th birthday, which is actually a huge milestone. You make it to 70 at that time, that was a big deal, and so they had a big 70th birthday bash, and it got a bunch of press coverage, and he thought, wait a minute, like my name's in the air. And it wasn't necessarily like good press. A lot of it was like, oh, Whitman's still around. Like, what a disgraceful poet he is. But he thought, wow, my name's in print again. And so he had a big 71st birthday bash.
He started having 3 birthdays a year.
He had a 72nd birthday bash. Yeah, he loved just to have his name in print, whether it was positive or negative. He just wanted people to be grappling with who he was and what he was doing.
You know, that is another question of mine. Like, yeah, how was he being received at the time? Who was he? And then, and also, Carrie, I want to know what Whitman has meant to your work, because I feel, you know, as a woman reading a lot of the Transcendentalists and reading Whitman, it's like there's a lot of man there. Like, what do you, how has it influenced your work?
Well, I mean, certainly, like, when you read as a poet, you know, when you read something like, you know, Whitman has always been an amazing influence. I was really into Emerson when I was young, when I was very young. I read Emerson, I'd go down to the ditch and read Emerson, Southern New Mexico. But when you read something like Howell, and you have the context for Howell having read Whitman, it really, you know, there's something enormous about it, about reading his work as a poet, and then also seeing it again and again, and seeing all the how poets have been influenced by him. And then I think also reading Whitman, and then kind of knowing that were Whitman and Keats alive at the same time ever? Or, I mean, Keats died at the age of 23. He only lived 23 years.
Yeah, I think Keats died when Whitman was maybe 5 years old or something like that. Yeah.
Whitman loved Keats. And so when I this is one of the things about having a poet like Whitman, or, I mean, there are other poets, where I was really resistant to Keats, to reading Keats. And then, you know, when you learn, okay, like, you know, well, what was it that Walt Whitman loved so much about these poems? And then it gives you a way of, like, entering into poems that you might not have, that you might have a resistance to, you know? And of course, you know, that one of the things that's so incredible about Walt Whitman is that he changed everything, you know? He did, so, oh, yeah, let me read this thing, yeah. This is really great. This is a book that I checked out of the library today. It's so 70s. It's like these photographs of America. And I checked it out. I think it was published in 1970. And I started looking at it, and then I realized that...
For the radio audience, it's The Illustrated Leaves of Grass.
Right. Copyright 1971. Very 1971. But it has an introduction by the poet William Carlos Williams, who is another poet who, in his time, changed everything and tried and changed everything. So in the introduction, just to move into this area, I thought I'd just read to you what he says about how Whitman was writing differently at the time. When Walt Whitman turned his back definitely on blank verse, and in the excitement of a poet's mind, imagined himself free, he was in the main mistaken. On the other hand, he established himself as the greatest poet we shall ever know. To speak of verse as free is a contradiction in terms, an impossibility. Measure is a sine qua non of all verse. Verse cannot exist without it. Walt Whitman abandoned blank verse, the iambic pentameter, and turned to the American idiom for release. By the same gesture, he turned away from an established custom. He was turning toward the unknown future, knowing that he did not know its profound implications. So can either of you maybe talk a little bit about what that meant? What did Whitman do to poetry?
You mean, wow, okay, large questions.
I mean, just in the sense of, you know, what came before him and where he went.
Sure. My instinct is to turn, of course, to British poets, and I'm thinking of Wordsworth here,
as one of the quintessential romantic poets who believed in the voice of the everyman, right? That we needed to be able to talk about quotidian, everyday experience in ways that are accessible to publics. And I think Whitman really took that to heart, right? To think about what free verse is, not free as in I can merely be free to express myself for who I am, but I make myself accessible in a language that every man spoke. And I think that is, I think, an ethical project and something that makes his poetry have a sense of power beyond sort of its particular context.
Could you just say more before Micah speaks? Could you say more what you mean about an ethical project?
I think whenever I teach poetry to students, I find that students will often describe their encounters with poetry as opaque or written in a way that is meant to either confuse meaning or written in a way that's not deliberately accessible to them. And in some ways, poetry does that with language. It makes language more difficult. But what I think is particularly ethical about, say, Wordsworth or Whitman's approach is that you can deal with the poetic in ways that don't necessarily confound language or are opaque to the readers. And I think there's a certain power in that, especially to use the words that you quoted earlier, American idioms that are familiar to their audiences. I think there's a certain power to that.
And that's William Carlos Williams who is writing that, who said, you know, no ideas but in things, and then tried to change it all, you know, himself, you know, tried to make language, you know, no ideas but in things, the red wheelbarrow, you know, this is just to say.
I was going to say, well, Travis's original comment, I really loved because you originally turned to the British and then you ended the comment with an idea about the spoken. And part of what Whitman did was turn from the British in the 1830s, you know, Emerson comes out with this Declaration of Literary Independence, like, can't we have some American literature that's not just copying off of the British? And then, like Carey, Whitman is an Emerson fanboy and is like, I'm gonna do that.
I'm gonna go to the ditch and
yeah,
read
I'm gonna
Emerson.
Do that. What would be in like an American vernacular and what would that mean about poetry? Weirdly, what we know Whitman for, which is the 1855 Leaves of Grass, he didn't actually know that he was writing poetry. He had conceived of it in a number of other ways. One of the ways which he was conceiving of it, which brings me back to your idea about the spoken, is that he thought it was going to be like an oratory that he was going to deliver on this. The Lyceum circuit actually garnered you a lot of money. You could go around and give these lectures, public lectures, and that was pretty lucrative. And so he thought, I'm going to make this kind of radical oratory, and what came from that was this free verse, and by free we mean, you know, it's not rhymed, it's not metered, and that's what produced Leaves of Grass, and it was so unrecognizable as poetry. It wasn't even conceived of as poetry when he was writing it, and then it was so unrecognizable as poetry that when he sent it out, people didn't know that it was poems. They called it wit and wisdom. They applauded him for things that weren't poetry. And that's why in the 1856 edition, he includes a letter that's like, here are all my poems. In two paragraphs, he uses the word poems like 37 times.
Enjoy my poems.
Yeah, and in the 1855 edition, none of the poems are actually titled. And then by the 1856 edition, they're all titled just so you guys know, these are poems. But that's how radical he kind of changed the game, because like, he didn't even know what he was doing at the time, and then he arrived on the scene in 1855 with these disgraceful-looking non-poems that no one recognized as such.
That's really incredible, isn't it? I mean, that's just really incredible. It's also really cool to think of Walt Whitman. I didn't know that he'd prepared them to perform them.
Yeah, he was hoping, I think, to be like America's first slam poet.
Yeah, right. I mean, maybe he was. So it didn't work out that way, though. No one wanted him to come and perform.
So that didn't work out. Although later in his life, he would actually garner some money giving public lectures, but mostly about the death of Abraham Lincoln,
right?
And not these slam performances of the verse he was writing.
I love that story about him sending Leaves of Grass to Emerson, and Emerson sending him back a letter that said, I greet you at the beginning of a great career. And then he publishes that that letter.
Yeah, to Emerson's chagrin.
Without Emerson's permission. And that causes a huge rift between them.
Well, like,
I'd be like, you know what? You wrote it.
Leave the it unconsenting happy. Blurb.
Yeah. Right. Right. He's so good at that. You know, one of the things about him speaking it out loud, it makes perfect sense because it's also very, to me, and also I heard a few other critics talk about this as like biblical. I mean, it's like, I believe, like his statements about belief are really interesting. Go ahead, Carrie, because well, your poems are biblical.
Biblical?
Well, I mean, they're, you know, in they're the, spiritual. In the sense, yeah.
They're, sensual?
And sensual.
Oh, I'm sorry. Spiritual. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about that. I mean, what was the religious and spiritual tradition in which like Whitman was coming from?
So his parents had sort of vague Quaker leanings. But if I had to describe Whitman's religiousness, it would be something like Emerson's, which is a kind of like Unitarian deism. Like he had a very unifying spirituality, but I don't think he really wanted to subscribe to any kind of dogmatic religion. But he did think of like Leaves of Grass. He was like, this is the new American Bible. I'm making a Bible. He even sort of calculated the pages of the Bible in comparison to Leaves
really?
Of Grass. Yeah.
So would he have described himself at the time as a Christian?
So he actually was, for the briefest of moments during the Civil War, a card-carrying member of, I think it's called the Christian Commission. He had two choices for helping out during the Civil War. One was called the Sanitary Commission, and the other was, I think, called the Christian Commission. And these were the people who were like helping wounded soldiers and circulating letters and getting care packages to soldiers. And he picked the Christian Commission. So literally, he was a card-carrying Christian, but I think he mostly resisted...
The Sanitary Commission?
He resisted the Sanitary Commission. But he definitely like resisted labels, although I would say like Leaves of, there are, you know, definite Christian overtones throughout the entirety of Leaves of Grass. And in fact, Harold Bloom, for one, thinks most of the end of Song of Myself is written from a Christ-like persona that Whitman's taking on. Jesus's voice at the end of Song of Myself, like the new American Jesus.
Wow. There you go. When you write your book on Whitman, the new American Jesus.
The new American Jesus.
There's your title. Travis, you know, I want to ask you, we had shared some letters and things before the show, and one of them was a letter from Bram Stoker to Walt Whitman. Can you talk a little bit about that letter, about Whitman's influence on Stoker, and then also, you know, his influence on the larger, you know, history of sexuality and gender?
So thank you for letting me... put on my British hat. So I spent a lot of time working on Bram Stoker's Dracula, and one of my favorite things whenever I teach my students is to show this archival letter in which pretty much Stoker expresses how much of a fanboy he is of Whitman's work, and his first version he doesn't send because he's too embarrassed of it. Sends another one and includes the unpublished original letter. And then Whitman writes back, and it's this sort of moment of fanness of two writers, one very early in his career, trying to figure out what literature can do for him, especially as somebody who is just beginning to write short fiction. The thing that people don't always remember about Bram Stoker was that he was also very active in the theater, and that's where he made most of his money. He worked with Henry Irving, who very famously did all of these sort of vampiric figures on the stage. But I think, whenever I think about that particular letter, I think about the ways in which intimacy was very much coded in this period. We have to think about, this is prior to the moment in which the word homosexual was actually codified as a term. Toward the end of the century, in 1895, Oscar Wilde will, of course, be put on trial for what is described as an indecency and a form of love that cannot speak its own name because it was seen as illicit and, in many ways, illegal. So think about
this interaction between Stoker and Whitman right at this moment in which their expressions of care for one another, admiration, are very much written in coded ways. And I think both, I think Whitman's particular way of talking about the body and its sexuality, its sensation, definitely filters into the way Stoker will imagine, say, Dracula and a number of the figures in that novel.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. And there was, so, and Stoker at the time was around 20, and Whitman was about 70, mm-hmm. or late 60s, 70?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there was quite an age difference there. Mm-hmm. Wow. And, you know, what? How has that, how is today Whitman, how is he embraced today?
I think this is a really fascinating question because I think that, like, you know, so many poets, rightfully, as hope, you know, as we, especially in you academics and scholars, continue to reimagine the canon and the place of certain poets in history. I wonder if you guys could speak a little bit about Whitman's legacy and how he and his poetry are viewed now. I don't know if maybe we need to speak a little bit about the political climate to give context to that, but...
You know, before we do that, too, Whitman is a very... When we talked about the difference between his pre-war and post-war relationship to the body, there's also a pre-war and post-war relationship to the black bodies and to slavery. And in the beginning, he's speaking about it as really elevating all bodies and all souls to the same level. And then he really wrestles with that during and after the war. So he has a very complex relationship with race that I think doesn't explicitly or overtly come out in his writings, in his published writings, but it is going on in his conversations and in the ways that he's just thinking about what that means. So maybe talk about the complexity of that too as we think about what he means today.
Sure. Well, actually, so Whitman's relationship to race does come out a little bit in his published writings, most problematically in his early journalism. He was an ardent free soiler. What that meant was that he thought any new territory added to the Union should not have slavery, but the already slaveholding states could retain slavery. He, at the time, thought abolitionism was getting in the way of its own cause, that ardent abolitionists were going to tear apart the Union, and he said some of his most racist stuff as an editorial writer for the Brooklyn Daily Eagle in his youth. And I've actually, you ask how he's embraced today. One of the things I'm working on in my dissertation is like people using Whitman politically on social media, and it really runs the gamut. There are far left radical progressives who are using Whitman. He featured largely in Occupy Wall Street. There are centrist figures.
How? In what way are they using him? You mean like?
Oh, there are like
him?
a lot of Occupy Wall Street tweets were quoting Whitman. Francine Prose wrote about how when she was in Zuccotti Park, she came across this sign that said "I contain multitudes," and she burst into tears. It was his book was one of the first books in the Occupy Wall Street library. And then there was this Occupy Wall Street poetry anthology, and Whitman featured very largely in the first poem. The very first line of the anthology is, in fact, "I apologize, Walt Whitman," and it was apologizing to Walt Whitman for the complacency that has led to this kind of hyper-capitalist moment that produced Occupy. And then two other poems in the anthology reference Whitman, so he was
Do you think that might also have to do with the fact that Occupy Wall Street was so centralized in New York City and, you know,
well, absolutely.
It's the island of
Manhattan. And it also makes a great deal of sense because at the beginning of capitalism and what capitalism was doing in the project was to cheapen certain bodies. So to cheapen them and in order to say that you didn't have to pay them, that they weren't part of, you know, this economic milieu that was going on, I guess. And to also cheapen nature, you know, that was the project of capitalism at the very beginning. So it would make perfect sense that to reclaim Whitman in Occupy Wall Street was a project of that.
And then how are people on? Where else are people using? This is all new.
So they're using Whitman across the gamut. So there are these like far left progressives using Whitman. Dan Rather is taking the centrist approach, which is like he's advertising his book What Unites Us, and so he's invoking the Whitman of the Civil War, the wound dresser who's going to suture the Union back together. And then I've seen him where I was getting to this was on the very far right. I've actually tracked Whitman's most racist quotations from the Brooklyn Daily Eagle in white nationalist subreddit communities, and they're using Whitman's racist quotations to shore up white nationalist sentiment. So he's really become so politically malleable that he's being used by all the camps and aisles.
Do you think that's unique to Whitman? Is it because he wrote so much? I mean, what is it, or you know, could someone do that with Ralph Waldo Emerson?
I don't know about using Emerson. I think there's something unique to Whitman. One is that you say he produced such a large corpus. He wrote so much that we're still uncovering his Men's Fitness column, and we just uncovered a lost novel we never knew he wrote.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and you know, Song of Myself contains so many persona that you can really cherry pick whatever you want. But the other thing was that he was consciously intersectional. So after the Civil War, when people were writing Civil War poetry, they were very much writing like, this book is dedicated to Union soldiers, this book is dedicated to the Union cause, this book is dedicated to the Union dead. Whitman's Civil War poetry refused to do that. None of the poems would explicitly mention which side they were talking about. They were very ambiguous about what flags they were describing when they were describing flags. He really wanted to be still the poet of sort of both sides of the divide. I mean, he really like takes "I contain multitudes" to heart, and so that's how you know anyone who wants to use him gets to use him.
Yet I think what I find really interesting is I've also heard a lot of resistance and pushback by queer poets and poets of color to Whitman in the ways in which desire, the body, is very much white in the way that it's invoked, especially I'm thinking of the Calamus poems and thinking about when certain parts of Whitman's poetry tend to be very bodily, they tend to be very white. And how does the presumed whiteness of the speaker come to stand in for American nationalism, about selfhood, right? What would it mean to think about other bodies being at the core of how Whitman might be thinking about desire, right? It's interesting to hear this sort of malleability, but also this intense pushback nowadays, I think, to the sort of overwhelming whiteness of Whitman's work.
Can you speak a little bit more specifically about like who are the poets right now who are making these arguments?
Yeah, so there
are critics or who? I mean, who is?
Yeah, there are a lot. Most recently, I taught Natalie Diaz was recently teaching here, and she has this incredible book. And in that book, the book is called When My Brother Was an Aztec, and there's a poem in it called Reservation Grasses. And it was a kind of stark, realistic portrait of childhood on a reservation that kind of makes a clap back at Walt Whitman, like, thanks Walt Whitman for that kind of optimistic manifest destiny that led to genocide and has led to reservations and the sort of current plight of Native Americans. Other poets who are kind of taking him to task are Claudia Rankine. Natasha Trethewey has like a conflicted relationship with him. She thought you were talking about the presumed white body of the speaker, and there's this incredible two-line poem called Reconciliation, and it's in his Civil War poems called Drum Taps. And whoever is the speaker, the eye of the poem is burying the dead, and the dead is said to be my enemy. These are the lips of my enemy, and I press my my face to the white lips of my enemy. And Natasha Trethewey, I think, reads that and thinks like, oh, this is a light. This is erasing all of the black participation in the Civil War, and so now I'm going to write this very beautiful collection of poems about Black Civil War soldiers. Although maybe what's missed is that Whitman very frequently takes on the persona of Black bodies, and in fact, the gravediggers on these war fields would probably have been Black, and it was very conspicuous to say, I press myself to the white face of my enemy.
That's Trethewey's book, Native Guard.
Yes,
she writes about that's the origin of that.
That's one of the germs for the yeah. And in fact, there's this whole book that came out about 4 years ago called Whitman Noir, and it's writers kind of grappling with Whitman and race. And she's one of the writers featured in that book, really sort of grappling with what Whitman means to Blackness.
And I think this Whitman's proclivity for impersonation or embodying a persona raises questions about who gets the right to embody or potentially appropriate a voice that is not his own. And I can definitely hear where that resistance and reservation can come from.
Well, we would love to open things up to some of your questions. And Amy Chambliss has the microphone. So just raise your hand and we'll come around to you.
I'm going to just say while the microphone is being passed around that I'm haunted right now because I think I said, did I say William Carlos Williams said no ideas but in things? Yes. Yes, okay. I feel like I might have said no ideas but in images, which is not at all what he said.
No.
Thank you. Now I can sleep. Now I can sleep tonight.
Go ahead.
Hey, this has been really fun so far, and I guess I'll start it off. And since I'm following up just what you guys were saying, also in Howard Zinn's People History of the United States, he mentions something Whitman wrote about eminent domain before the Civil War. I think he was writing like in a journal that was not nice. It was just about conquest and taking things. But I was wondering if you could talk about because a lot has been about, that you've been talking about is about Whitman, the person who lived, but what about just Whitman, the subject or subjects of Leaves of Grass, you know, because like he's born in two different places and it's like a very contradictory, you know, multiple personalities person in a way, you know, so.
I just want to clarify, what do you mean, what, can you say, what, I don't, do you, I'm not sure what you mean by born in two places.
Oh, yeah, there's a line, I think Borges, I can't remember the two places, one's in Brooklyn, and another one is in another line of verse, he mentions he's born somewhere else. Sorry.
Long Island, is it?
I can't remember.
Or maybe in Huntington, Long Island.
Yeah, Borges, in Borges' essay on Whitman, he quotes the two lines, but I don't have it with me.
Okay, so he says in two different places that he was born in two.
Yeah, like two okay. different, two different, totally different poems. But it's kind of like the idea Borges is saying is that Whitman, the Whitman that we know is a Whitman that didn't exist.
Right, you know, like he was constructed. Right. He's a mythology.
He constructed,
constructed his own mythology.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it makes sense that you bring up Borges because the eye in Leaves of Grass is this kind of garden of forking paths. And the biographical Whitman is kind of weaving in and out of it. Sometimes he says, like, I, Walt Whitman, now 37 years of age. I, Walt Whitman, one of the roughs of cosmos. But at other times, he's taking on other personas. I, the hounded slave. At other times, the I seems like really ambiguous and all-encompassing. And that was part of what was so radical about Leaves of Grass in 1855. The character of Walt Whitman kind of blinks in and out of it, and he is the I, and he isn't the I, and he's smaller than the I, and he's bigger than the I. But, you know, this brings us back to, like, when we first opened up this panel talking about Whitman and the body. If you open up the title page of the 1855 Leaves of Grass, his name isn't actually on the title page. He leaves his name off the title page. It's the title page says Leaves of Grass. It has the year. But opposite the title page, there's this frontispiece. And normally, frontispieces of the time would have, you know, the very distinguished head of the aristocrat because they're very cerebral and this whole book is going to be imagined out of their genius. But Walt Whitman's frontispiece was the entirety of his body, and he's wearing workman's clothes, and he's kind of giving like a wry a smile in these workman's clothes, and he's leaning and loafing. And so his body definitely is a character in Leaves of Grass. And then, but he leaves Walt Whitman off the title page, but then that does and doesn't become a character of Leaves of Grass. So it's this very sort of proto-Borges kind of feeling that you get from this character.
I'm thinking also about earlier 18th and 19th century poets. I'm thinking also about William Blake and this culture, I think this poetic culture of myth-making and attaching oneself to prophetic figures imagined religious, for instance, and I see Whitman doing that in his conception of self, thinking about within the multitude, if one does contain multitudes, many of them could be archetypal figures, people that come in and out of one's life. So I think this particular brand of myth-making has been going on about a century before and definitely traveling through Whitman.
And, you know, we just interviewed Lisa Moore about Audrian Rich. And she has this poem, Diving into the Wreck. And this is taken on in the end of Diving into the Wreck, where she says, do you know that, the line, we, me, I, are? Do you know?
Written into the Book of Life.
Yeah.
Book of Myths.
And I'll just read it here, the very end of it, because I think it's interesting to think about Whitman.
Not written
Whitman.
Into the Book of Myths,
no.
Actually.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about this idea of the myth-making and the difference in I, and she writes, we are, I am, you are, by cowardice or courage, the one who find our way back to this scene, carrying a knife, a camera, a book of myths in which our names do not appear. I'm just going to leave that right there. So another question?
Can I just ask a question real quick? Is there a definitive kind of biographical account of Whitman's life? Could you read a book? Is there a book out there where you could read and go like, okay, yes, so this is what he says about himself, but this is how his life went down?
Yeah, there are a few. I would say the one that most people consider like the definitive Whitman biography is written by a guy, I think he was in fact out of Texas A&M, named David Reynolds. And I forget the exact name of the biography, but it's the David Reynolds biography.
Though arguably, I think any definitive biography would be explicitly non-Whitmanian to do. So.
Right, right.
And also, Micah, if you could talk about what they have at the Harry Ransom Center.
So when you were talking about the letters, are those Stoker letters there? What do they have at the Ransom Center that belonged to Walt Whitman?
They have more than 400. It's hard for me to summarize because they have more than 400
things.
What is
the weirdest thing they have?
Oh gosh, the weirdest thing.
I know they have like pieces of, like they have locks of John Keats's hair.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The thing I like the most is what I was describing earlier, where Whitman's sort of doing the math on his book and the pages in his book, and he's comparing it to other big books, like he's comparing it to Shakespeare's plays, and he's comparing it to the Bible. And the manuscript page on which he's like doing that long division and the addition and subtraction is here at the Harry Ransom Center.
That's amazing.
And then to go back to Bram Stoker, the Harry Ransom Center also has... Bram Stoker became obsessed, well, Whitman became obsessed with Lincoln's death. Bram Stoker became obsessed with Whitman's obsession with Lincoln's death. And so Bram Stoker asks for Whitman's Lincoln lecture with original notes. So Whitman has his Lincoln lecture bound up with original notes and sent to Bram Stoker, and we have that here too.
And is this going to be on display? Are they going to...
So we just digitized 10 bound volumes of Whitman's original manuscripts and early proof. So if you go to the Harry Ransom Center website and you go to digital collections, you can pull up the Walt Whitman collection and you can see 10 bound volumes, one of which is the Lincoln Lecture for Bram Stoker.
Wow. Another question?
Hi there. This has been really fascinating and a really rich discussion. I really appreciate how we've talked a lot about Whitman's biography and the influences of his physical life, and of course, the formal attributes of Whitman breaking the line and how substantial that is. Whenever I read Whitman, which is quite often, I'm really impressed by not only the formal innovation of breaking the line, but of the sort of aesthetic complication of Whitman's line in and of itself. It seems like that dictum, "I contain multitudes," is contained in the aesthetic variety of an individual line, where several different ontological stances are taken at once, from the sensual to the intellectual to the religious, and so on and so forth. And that's in a way that is almost Shakespearean, the density of it and the pressure on the language. And I think that is predominantly Whitman's, one of Whitman's really generous gifts to contemporaneity. And I know, Micah, you're a poet, and Carrie, you're a poet. So I'm curious how Whitman's emphasis on language in and of itself has influenced your aesthetics.
Travis, you're also a poet.
And Travis.
And we're all poets. Rebecca's a poet.
And David, you're a poet.
I've written a couple of
them. Raise your hand if you're a poet.
But I like what you said, the pressure on language. I like that. But
well, a moment ago we were talking, was it Emerson who said you have these catalogs and any one of them could be their own, the sort of...
No, that was William Carlos Williams. William Carlos Williams' whole deal was like, good for you, Walt Whitman, you've done this genius thing, but actually like any one of these lines is a Red Wheelbarrow poem.
Yes. He's like, I only had to do it, you know, took me, and then I'm done.
I was, I think Ezra Pound has a poem called A Pact that says something, I'm paraphrasing, like, Walt Whitman, it was you who chopped the wood, and now it's our time to hew it.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry, was your question, how has the way that he changed the line influenced us as poets? Oh, yeah, Well, it's just so lush, you know? There is a certain free, like, you know, freeness in that line. I see it also in, and I don't know if he read Whitman in translation or not, but I see that in like Neruda's poems as well.
Oh, absolutely. Huge Whitman.
Yeah. Oh, can you speak a little bit about that? He was a huge Whitman. Did he read in English?
That I don't know. I mean, I do know Whitman was very early translated into Spanish and featured largely.
Where's our Neruda translator?
He's out with the baby.
He's out with his baby.
But you know, I was thinking about this idea of the body. You know, and the way that Whitman talks about the body and what was happening to the body during the Victorian period and the corsets and the violence especially toward the women's body. And I was thinking like, maybe Walt Whitman is kind of like the Coco Chanel of poetry.
Changed it all?
Yeah. He like loosened the corsets, right? He like let it go. Let it go, right?
Well, part of...
I don't know. The Diane von Furstenberg? No. We're going to go with Coco Chanel. I'm just going to own that right there.
I'm always struck by the way in which the Victorian period tends to be represented as repressive, but in many ways they were actively dealing with the complexities of the body, be it in the form of death or in sexuality. But what I find particularly Victorian about Whitman's writing is the unabashed presence of the body and its sometimes unpleasant or undesirable qualities, just as sexuality is equally as prominent. And I think in many ways, you see him working through what can a body do, what capacities does it have, what are the limits of a body, and because he's so good at sort of flowing through different personas, you get to see different bodies in motion. I kind of like that.
Yeah, and he's taken to be, you know, a very influential person on like gender studies, on human sexuality, and also just discovering the human body. Like he writes about masturbation a lot in his poetry.
I mean, at a period in which masturbation was seen as sinful and was deeply regulated, my favorite story is like the history of the graham cracker, which was used as an anti-masturbation device so that people would eat the graham cracker instead of masturbating. So it's like, good to know that Whitman was participating in this time.
I did just read that the graham cracker was invented in like 1888.
One of the most radical moments to me in Song of Myself is this... in this Victorian period, he depicts a female orgasm. He depicts female masturbation and a female orgasm, and he takes on the persona of a woman who's looking out on 28 naked men bathing in the river, and that section of Song of Myself ends with a woman's orgasm in 1855.
It's fascinating. I think we have time for just one more question. Do we? I think so. Anyone? Feel free to not ask a question. Masturbation just silenced the room. Debbie.
Hello, it's Debbie. Hi. I guess my question is, I remember just like growing up and in like English, like reading What Women and all this other stuff, and now learning as an adult, like, yo, like, he's complex and like he has these things where it's like, okay, we're gonna like be for everyone, but then also be racist, but then also have this. It's like very complex. So like, how do you, as poets, as scholars of Walt Whitman, like how do you like grapple, especially you, Travis, as a person of color, how do you grapple with like a person where it's like, yo, like he was great, but also has these problematic things as a person?
Yeah. That's the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a great question.
I mean, that's probably the question I've been dealing with the most in sort of my recent foray into poetry. My experience with Whitman was also in high school. I grew up in a suburb of Atlanta, which was predominantly white, Baptist. And I remember we had a unit on Whitman, and his queerness was just not a thing that we ever discussed. This is, of course, in the same high school curriculum in which issues of race were not discussed in our discussion of Huckleberry Finn. So it's telling to me the ways in which certain canonical white poets are sanitized in certain ways. And I think about that, especially now as an educator, my responsibility for confronting the ways in which certain writers have been sanitized and to what ends, right? Like that's, I think, the question that we have to ask ourselves. Why is it that we don't want to confront his racism, his sexism, and the ways in which we've told the story about somebody as necessarily straight, for instance? Or why is the queerness so unbearable in the way in which a poet is received? And I'm trying to think about that a lot now.
And you're talking about now, you know? It's not in Whitman's time, it's in our time. Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, it's you sent a, was this over the we've been texting and emailing about this for a while. You sent an article, and I didn't open it. Great story, right?
Thanks, Carrie.
But the title of the title of the essay was "Should Walt Whitman Be Canceled?" Yeah. Yeah.
It was good.
Yeah. So yeah. Well, yeah. So I can't talk about it because I didn't.
Well,
read
no,
it.
And Debbie has put it up on our social media.
Oh, great!
Too, so
yeah.
Good. So
yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah.
But you know, it is, I think, difficult. I mean, not only for scholars, but for artists and people in general, readers as well, people, to, I think, grapple is the great word there. That's the word. I mean, you can't excuse, you can't. But I also hesitate to say, well, Walt Whitman should be canceled. You know, the word canceling, like the idea of canceling someone's voice entirely, is that the answer to it? You know.
Well, especially because the idea of canceling is like, to me, the reason I'm drawn to Walt Whitman as a poet is because his poetry is better than him. His poetry is better than his person. His poetry is more radical than his racist person. His poetry is better than his journalism. His poetry is better than his bad novels. And that's something I aspire to like find a speech that's better than me. But I'd also like to share the most fascinating answer I've gotten to a similar question, which is there's this incredible poet named Mina Alexander, very recently late poet Mina Alexander. She just passed away. And she's an Indian American poet. And last year at the Whitman Symposium, she was giving the keynote address, and someone put it to her because one of Whitman's most problematic poems is one called Passage to India, you can imagine. And so they're like, Mina, like, what are you doing? How can you kind of grapple with this man when there's this Passage to India poem, for instance? And Mina just looked out and said, oh, I just cross out the bad parts and read the good ones.
That is fascinating. Well, and you know, on that same thing, right before we close, because we're just about ready to close, and Carrie has something fantastic to read, but this idea also of spaces to become, I think, is really interesting. You know, where do we have spaces where we can grapple with our own complexities in public? You know, there is very little private sphere anymore where we can really contemplate things and come to terms with them.
And containing multitudes, you know, if you cancel someone, I mean, we all contain parts of our, we all are still grappling with these things in our own self, hopefully, you know, we all are. I would love to end, if we can, with a
plan. I'd love to end. Yes. Well, coming to a close, Carrie, go ahead.
Yes. I was hoping that I could wrap up with a poem by the American poet Marie Howe, who lives in Manhattan, and writes in this poem toward, well, I'm not just going to read the poem. One Day, by Marie Howe. One day. One day, the patterned carpet, the folding chairs, the woman in the blue suit by the door, examining her split ends, all of it will go on without me. I'll have disappeared as easily as a coin under lake water, and few to notice the difference. A coin dropping into the darkness. And West 4th Street, the sesame noodles that taste like too much peanut butter, lowered into the small white paper carton, all of it will go on, and the eye that caused me so much trouble, nowhere. Or grit thrown into the garden, or into the sticky bodies of several worms, or just gone, stopped, like the Middle Ages, like the coin Whitman carried in his pocket all the way to that basement bar on Broadway that isn't there anymore. Oh, to be in Whitman's pocket on a cold winter day, to feel his large, warm hand slide in and out and in again, to be taken hold of by Walt Whitman, to be exchanged, to be spent for something somebody wanted and drank and found delicious.
It's such a great, I think that's such a great, like the thing that I read to begin and then that to end with as well. Just
it's beautiful. Well,